are the amount of angle that your finger, for example, right now is on the is the sign that, for example, you are angry in some amount or something like that.
See, these psychologist matters that recently has been so
somehow,
much on.
But, you know, I'm always about right now. It's sometimes about your future.
Yeah.
For example, that person see you and he'll understand your future somehow in some amount because he has many experience or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
This is, I think, prediction. I mean, you say something and from these strong evidences.
But we're not talking about prediction.
Logically, yeah, I know.
And we're talking about fortune telling.
Exactly. I want to talk about fortune telling. And first of all, I want to talk about from religious point of view. From religious point of view, there were miracles in the history because other people had to understand that this person is different. This person is, a person who is sent from God, mm-hmm. No one else. And this person should be able to do something that other people can't do. And this is called mu'jiz or miracle, the history. And one of these miracles, even in Islam, was fortune-telling not fortune-telling exactly, somehow seeing the future.
Yeah.
You know what? Even in Quran, one of the miracles of Quran was at that time, the Muslims were aware of the, for example, fights. And in the verses, for that time, it was a miracle or something. I do believe in that part.
Mm-hmm.
But unfortunately, today, it has become a business.
They're trading with people's future.
Exactly.
And they sell it to other people on an amount which is going to make them wealthy and make the other person so much terrified of the future to come.
Exactly. And this is somehow superstitious part of the...
Yeah, of course.
In a result, they might have information that are quite right.
Mm-hmm.
No, these information are taken from the supernatural world. So you cannot say that these are superstitious. But the case is that they are illegal information for us.
Mm-hmm. I can
the fact is
it.
This one. As just Asma said, imagine that you go to a fortune teller and then she or he would tell
you. I won't go.
No, imagine I would go.
Yeah, yes, Asma, you can imagine that you go to him or her and then she would tell you that, okay, in 10 years, you would lose your mother, for example.
Oh, my God.
You would get divorced. One of my friends, she used to visit lots of fortune tellers. And they told her that you would marry to a man who has got divorced and has one child.
Wow.
And she was still unmarried at that time. And she was constantly waiting for a marriage. The fortune teller told her that you would get divorced once and then you would get married to that man. So she was constantly waiting for that moment to get married and then get divorced and then get married again to a man who has a child and is divorced too.
This is a disaster. Come on. In this case, I think she wanted to. She wanted this to happen
to her. We just talked about it, Bita. See, I do believe that. And we also have the story of the magicians in the Holy Book of Quran. There are some sort of people who would do many things. They even would deal with the devil in order to get some, as just Zainab said, some forbidden, forbidden news, forbidden knowledge.
Yes, forbidden knowledge.
We could call it the forbidden knowledge. Because it's only God who knows our future.
Yes.
And it's only Him who can unfold it for us. There is no other person unless they have some connection with some spiritual world.
Creatures. Maybe.
Yeah, and creatures. And we talked about it, the jinns, that we have it also in the Holy Book of Quran. They do magics. They would do some dirty, tricky things in order to get into the future of other people. And many times... those people would tell you things that are terribly true.
Yes.
So the only justification for that is that they have a connection to a forbidden knowledge that has been achieved by them through some dirty tricks.
But I think this forbidden knowledge, will destroy them. Not only them, but also the people that will understand their future.
Yes.
Yes, also, exactly.
Also, just to shed light in that point as well, that in our narrations, in our religion, we have it that there were plenty much of saints and plenty much of holy people like Ahlul Bayt alayhim salam, mm-hmm. who had the forbidden knowledge, but they never shared it with anyone. And if they shared it, it was on some special occasions.
Yes.
That telling that would do some change. Telling that would, help a nation.
Even it was the God guidelines, you know.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah,
even God
true.
Has blamed those who go to fortune tellers.
Yeah.
You know, the 59th verse of Surah Al-An'am, God says that with him are the keys to the unseen and none knows it except him alone.
Yeah.
You know, nothing is known by human beings except for God. No, and that is why God wants us not to be curious about our future.
Yeah.
No, God has, and again, we have in another narration from the Holy Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam, the prayer or the salat of whoever approaches a fortune teller and asks him about anything will not be accepted for 40 days and nights.
Oh my!
Can you see that?
Yeah.
Can you see that? The Holy Prophet has forbidden us. There is a danger in this action.
Let's go for a short break and we'll be back. Thank you for listening. What we're talking about right now is about fortune tellers, and that, yes, it exists. There are some people who could do that, but there are two types of that. We as Muslim people believe that the true source of those fortune tellers are Ahlul Bayt alayhim salam, who are holy and they have a connection to Allah himself. So they are the ones who know about our future. And there's no one who could unfold the unknown future for us except them. The other stuff that we hear and we might hear from people is just superstition, or if it's not superstition, it's some dirty magic that is going to affect our life and the life of other people who are around us. Another important thing is that there is no need to go for fortune tellers, since in Islam we have a way of living. God has told us if you practice generosity, then you're going to have a double of the things that you're giving to other people. If you practice this or that, you're going to have a happy future. If you practice charity works, if you spend much of money on people who are in need of that money, then God would save you from 70 disasters that might get into your way, into your life. If you do this or that, plenty much of goodness would happen.
You know,
and also we have mm-hmm. it, if you do something bad, if you take the money of an orphan, then you're going to
then
be retaliated. Yes, it's going
yes.
to be like hell on earth.
Yes.
So there's no way to go for the fortune tellers because everything has been told to us. We have the Holy Book of Quran. It works like an instruction book. It has given us everything. Still, I know that the story of fortune telling is something pretty much interesting, and it's better for us to go for the word of Allah and Ahlul Bayt alayhim salam. I hope you enjoyed today's session. That's all the time that we've got for today's episode. Thank you for staying with us.
Ya Allah, Ya Rabb al-Alamin, Ya Rahman, Ya Rahim, Ya Rabbi. Let the Ummah rise again. Ya Allah, Ya Rabb al-Alamin, Ya Rahman, Ya Rahim, Ya Rabbi. Let the Ummah rise again. Let us see daylight again, once again.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Beruba Shavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Said Pureza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Said Amin Olemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the World with Reporters.
A once foreign minister, Amir Abdullahian, has paid a visit to EP House, an NGO supporting patients suffering from a rare skin disorder that causes the skin to become fragile, known as epidermolysis bullosa. During the visit, which came on the occasion of the EP Awareness Week, Iran's top diplomats said imposing unilateral sanctions have become a modern tool for the U.S. to violate human rights.
Imposing unilateral sanctions have become a modern tool for the U.S. to violate human rights. There are 1,300 EB patients in Iran, but Sweden refuses to give special bandages to these patients. This comes as Westerners have repeatedly declared that sanctions do not include patients and medicine, but in practice, they act the opposite.
The Swedish company Mölnlycke Healthcare has refused to sell Iranian EB patients medical care items they needed, including Mepilex dressings. Several children in Iran who suffered from epidermolysis bullosa lost their lives due to the lack of urgently needed medical equipment, and some others were hurt by severe physical injuries, including amputation.
Iran has serious problems in procuring wound dressings for EB patients. These dressings are produced in Sweden, but the country refrains from providing us with the bandages because of the U.S. sanctions. Our center has filed a lawsuit in the judiciary of the Islamic Republic to pursue the problem, and we expect the Foreign Ministry and the administration of President Raisi to follow up the case because the lives of my daughter and other patients are in danger.
Many human rights groups have criticized the U.S. for cutting off banking ties with Iran through threatening international banks with punitive fines by the U.S. Department of Treasury, which has resulted in cutting Iranian patients' access to necessary medical items. Tens of Iranian EB patients, mostly children, have died since Swedish company Mölnlycke stopped selling its dressings to Iran. Since then, for EB survivors, the pain has increased by 70%. Iran says the West is taking revenge on Iranians by waging a campaign of genocide against patients, believing that the sanctions have become the backbone of the so-called American human rights regulations. Saman Kujurip, Tehran.
A high-ranking Palestinian delegation has met Syrian President Bashar al-Assad in Damascus. Arriving from Algeria, officials discussed the result of their meetings there for reconciliation among Palestinians. Assad underlined the importance of unity among Palestinians as a source of strength in the face of the Israeli aggression and for regaining their rights. He asserted that Syria will always remain in support of resistance against Israel. Members of the delegation expressed appreciation for Syria's historic support to Palestinians, describing it as their safe haven during hardships. They said they stand beside Syria in this years-long war waged by the U.S. and its allies. Following the meeting, representatives of Palestinian factions held a press conference.
The president welcomed us in an open heart and expressed Syria's love to Palestine, Palestinians, Palestinian cause and resistance, as well as determination for this meeting to pave the way for a new phase of relations between Syria and Palestinian factions.
The most significant aspect of the visit was that Hamas officials were present. This is their first visit to Syria in a decade after they left, cutting ties with the Syrian government at the start of Syria's crisis. During the press conference, Hamas officially announced the restoration of relations with Syria.
This is a glorious and important day. We restore our presence in Syria and joint action with Syrian-based Palestinian factions and the Syrian government in support of our cause. We told Assad that we support a unified Syria and we are against any aggression on Syria.
The visit comes shortly after Palestinian factions came together under Algerian Reconciliation Initiative, in which they met and agreed to end disputes and division for the sake of unifying ranks in the face of Israel. Palestinian factions' visit to Syria reiterates the Arab country's pivotal role in supporting Palestinian resistance against Israel, even during the war it is facing. And receiving Hamas officials in Damascus is yet another proof of Syria's commitment to the Palestinian cause, despite Hamas's stance over the Syrian crisis and disagreements in 2012. Hamad Ali, Damascus.
Okay. Since the beginning of the Saudi-led coalition war on Yemen on March 2015, attacks on education centers have severely disrupted access to education. A recent UN report says over 2,900 schools have been destroyed, partially damaged, or used for non-educational purposes. Even though the world body did not mention the cause of the destructions in its report, most of the schools were hit by the Saudi aerial attacks.
Since the beginning of the war against our country, the Saudi-led coalition has been seeking to target the educational system because the enemy realizes the importance of education and its role in the society. So the coalition cut the salaries of employees, including teachers, which negatively affected the country's education. Due to the war, we were only able to print a very small percentage of the textbooks, and the poor living conditions forced many children to leave education and enter the labor market to support their families.
For its part, the International Committee of the Red Cross has urged the international community to save the education system in the country. It says there are over 2 million children out of school and over 8 million students need support to access education.
Over 2 million children don't have access to proper education in Yemen, and one out of four of all primary and secondary schools have been damaged or have been used for purposes other than what they're intended for. This is exacerbated by internally displaced people using some schools as shelters as they are forced to flee from their homes to escape the ongoing conflict. Of course, education will have long-lasting effects and ramifications that will indeed impact the Yemeni people for generations to come.
Structured learning has been further hindered as 172,000 teachers have been irregularly paid since 2016, while some have not been paid at all. Sadly, some teachers could not even cover the transportation costs as they are working voluntarily.
Despite all the challenges, education remains the safety net for future generations. Therefore, Yemenis say they will keep pushing their children to schools, hoping to build a generation that will reconstruct the country after the Saudi-led war. Abdul Latif Loshali, Sana'a.
Following weeks of unrest between Muslims and Hindus in the English Midlands city of Leicester, the local mayor has ordered an inquiry to get to the bottom of what's behind the rise in local tensions. Following the inquiry's launch, Leicester City Mayor Peter Salisbury met with local Muslim community activists on October the 11th, who expressed fears that the violence was largely the result of the arrival of an Indian Hindu supremacist political ideology known as Hindutva on British shores.
Lots of tough words. You'd expect that. I mean, it's quite right. People, you know, are concerned about what happened, concerned about what it means, concerned about the ideology that lies behind it.
A Press TV investigation into the unrest found that a number of local Muslim residents had been hospitalised this year following attacks allegedly carried out by Islamophobic Hindu gangs, likely inspired by India's Hindutva ideology. Muslim activists informed Press TV that locals felt the police had failed to protect their community, leading to a fight back.
However, it isn't just Muslims who fear the arrival of Hindutva. British Sikhs are also well acquainted with the supremacist ideology, which preaches total intolerance of all of India's religious minorities.
The Hindutva is a fascist ideology that seeks the racial, social, religious purity of India and unification of India as an embodiment of Hinduism. So one nation, one language, and now with Modi, one market, where the Hindu is the human, the Hindu is the subject that is protected, and every other minoritized community is a threat, a potential threat to the integrity of India. It's a mythical project.
Hindu organizations in Britain have condemned the violence, but none seem to have acknowledged the accusations of Hindutva-inspired hate as a cause to the troubles. Muslim and Sikh onlookers hope that the inquiry will put the Hindutva ideology firmly under the spotlight. Robert Carter, London.
Washington is poised to spearhead yet another military intervention in protest-racked Haiti and will even propose a non-United Nations mission to do so. Anti-government protesters have become routinely labeled gang members in the Western mainstream media. However, many say that such a negative characterization aims to smooth Western public opinion for the use of force in Haiti yet again.
Even calling them gangs in some ways might be misleading. Some of these groups are political organizations, and the state is so weak because state institutions have been eroded by neoliberal policies, by corruption, by neocolonial policies, that these forces that are leading these protests could potentially have the power to overthrow this U.S. puppet government.
Haitian instability escalated following the 2021 assassination of President Jovenel Moïse by Colombian mercenaries. Western mainstream media have reported that several of the assassins worked alongside U.S. intelligence groups. Haitian media accuses Washington of hiding evidence to keep its role in the murder a mystery.
Who replaced him? A U.S. puppet named Ariel Henry, who's the current president. Ariel Henry has no democratic mandate, and he has a long history of serving U.S. imperial interests in Haiti. In fact, he got his political start in being involved in the coup backed by the U.S. that ousted the progressive, popular president, Aristide, who was the first ever democratically elected president of Haiti.
Haitian civil society groups have emphatically rejected the prime minister's call for foreign intervention. There is also widespread denunciation for the West, which continues to back the government despite its decision to indefinitely postpone elections and a constitutional referendum. Many protesters have called upon Beijing and Moscow to use their UN Security Council veto to reject an official United Nations mission. In 2010, UN peacekeepers caused an outbreak of cholera which killed 10,000 Haitians and infected nearly 1 million, with sexual assault scandals commonplace. For over two centuries, Haitian sovereignty has been regularly subjugated, first by France and then by the United States. Ramin Mazahiri, Chicago.
After weeks of economic and political turmoil, an early announcement by the UK's new finance minister aimed at calming the nerves at home and abroad.
Although the Prime Minister and I are both committed to cutting corporation tax, on Friday she listened to concerns about the mini-budget and confirmed we will not proceed with a cut to corporation tax announced.
And with that, Jeremy Hunt reversed most of an economic package announced by his predecessor, Kwasi Kwarteng, just weeks ago, including a planned cut to income tax.
It made no sense economically, it made no sense politically, and basically the markets couldn't make any sense of it either. So basically, you've ended up wasting a lot of time and energy reversing a stupid policy that was put in the first place. Simple as that.
But not everything is being reversed. The government is still going to end the cap on bankers' bonuses, meaning bankers will be able to take home more than double their fixed salary when the change is made. And then there is the cap on household energy bills, Liz Truss's most popular policy, that was supposed to be in place for 2 years. It'll now be reviewed in April next year. Much of the economic and political turbulence in the UK is blamed on the war in Ukraine and unpredictable global market forces. Many experts say there is another important culprit.
Ultimately, a lot of this nonsense and the idiocy of Boris Johnson, the idiocy of Liz Truss, actually, its roots are in Brexit. Because what has Brexit done to the British economy? It's basically knocked 4 to 5% off the GDP. That's led to a loss of tax revenues for the government. It's led to problems for business because they haven't got the supply of labour that they need. All right? And it's basically acted and a huge waste of money, of course, on customs officials and this and that, and the bureaucracy for business.
Liz Truss's premiership has been nothing less than a roller coaster. Her decisions have given the opposition Labour Party a comfortable lead in opinion polls and badly damaged her credibility with her own party.
With the new Chancellor ripping up her economic plan, the Prime Minister now has to regain support of the MPs. But with the amount of plotting that's going on against her, whether or not she can do that is anyone's guess. Saeed Bourza, London.
The The streets of Rubeznoy in northern Donbass resemble an apocalypse. There was a major battle here between Russian and Ukrainian forces. It's now under Russian control, and the threat of incoming artillery now comes from the Ukrainian side.
Now, the Russians have been in control of this town for a couple of months now, but we've heard of a school that was hit very recently by Ukrainian artillery, so we're going to go there now and have a look.
School number 10. Locals say it was American HIMAR missiles that are responsible for these scenes. A decision will have to be made on whether to tear down the school or to attempt to repair the damage.
It was shelled on the 23rd of September. There was no military there. I live in the house in front of it, and I never saw any military. I'm the head of the educational department. They were preparing that school for the start of educational process, and we're cleaning it in preparation. Half of the school is destroyed.
We were planning to open 3 schools, but one school, number 10, wasn't able to open because it was hit by HIMARS. Luckily, it was at night and there was nobody there. It was during the referendum. It was hit on purpose, and it was hit directly because there's still some people in this town who are pro-Ukrainian, so they tell them where to strike.
While I've reported for many schools in Donbass that have been directly targeted by Ukraine, it's not clear whether this was hit due to its association with the recent referendum on joining Russia. Across the playground, a block of flats. One of the missiles landed outside this old woman's apartment. She calls the Ukrainians who did this cursed fascists, then bursts into tears. She was wounded in the blast and only recently returned from hospital. Inside, her kitchen has been blown out.
I'm nearly 70 and I'm afraid. Everybody is leaving. But where do we leave to? When the shell landed, I went out into the kitchen and looked. So I crawled under the bed. Everything is crumbling down. I woke up at night when a piece of wallpaper fell and covered me.
The American HIMAR missile system is amongst the most advanced pieces of military hardware in the world. Each missile costs $150,000. In Rubeznoy, they are being used to blow up schools and terrorize old women. Johnny Miller, Rubeznoy.
The Prisoners Affairs Committee of Sana'a signed the last list of prisoners with Saudi Arabia, under which inmates will be exchanged between Sana'a and Riyadh. Head of the committee, Abdul Qadir al-Murtada, said the database that was an obstacle to the implementation of the agreement has been corrected.
The 4 Geneva Conventions, especially the 3rd Convention on the Protection of Prisoners, mention the rules for the protection of prisoners as a humanitarian issue, and no party should link it to political matters. Unfortunately, countries on the Saudi-led coalition are working in line with the agenda of America and Israel, so it made no move until receiving American directives, and this has always been a hurdle to solving the rest of the issues.
Al-Murtada said a visit by the Sana'a delegation to Saudi prisons was successful, as the Yemeni prisoners were reassured that the swap deal would move forward. He hoped that the reciprocal visits will be a first step towards settling the humanitarian issue of the prisoner exchange.
The results of the recent visits were positive. The lists were corrected for both parties, and the names that will be exchanged between us and Saudi Arabia in the coming days have been signed. We in the National Committee for Prisoners Affairs consider the prisoners' issue as a humanitarian one. We should not be linked to military or political matters. If all parties are serious enough to resolve this issue, it will open up prospects for setting other issues as well.
Recently, a Saudi technical delegation visited Sana'a, while another from the Prisoners Affairs Committee of Sana'a entered Riyadh to verify the names of prisoners of both parties.
The warring sides in Yemen have taken a new step toward peace by visiting each other for the first time. Observers say if the prisoner swap deal moves forward, it could help end the war. Abu Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
Muslim religious and community leaders from a variety of sects gathered in London on Sunday for the 24th International Islamic Unity Conference. The annual event, held at the Islamic Centre of England, aims to promote religious unity, combat sectarianism, and defend Islamic values.
This event coincides with a similar Islamic Unity Conference held annually inside Iran. The Islamic Republic has come under a sustained attack in recent weeks by Western groups advocating for regime change following the unfortunate death of Iranian woman Mahsa Amini.
Many groups are involved in backing the anti-Iran riots, most notably Western-based Iranian dissidents and supporters of the MKO terrorist group. Although they are divided on doctrine, one factor unites them: Islamophobia.
They are hijacking maybe an agenda to portray this clash of civilization, and they are portraying this narrow-minded, neoconservative narrative that Muslims are barbaric, Muslims are narrow-minded, and Muslims need to be liberated. And this was the type of language that was used at the dawn of the second and the first Gulf Wars, of trying to say, we're here to liberate Muslims, we're here to liberate their countries, and this is very dangerous.
These are actual people who have an agenda to make Muslims and Islam enemy number one across the world. So whether it's targeting the Islamic government and the Velayat-e Faqih system in Iran, or whether it's attacking a woman with hijab on the streets of East London, actually the phenomena is rooted in the same thing. It's an actual organised attack on Muslims.
The anti-Iran riots have expanded to include an international campaign condemning Islam and Islamic concepts, such as the hijab. It's now up to Muslim leadership to find ways of combating the tide of anti-Muslim abuse. Initiatives such as this intend to inspire a fight back. Robert Carter, London.
Ask the followers of the remembrance if ye know not.
You're listening to the program The Key on IRIB English Radio with Shiraz Hossein Agha, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Rome and a PhD in philosophy.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome to our program, The Key, here at IRIB English Radio. Today on The Key, we're going to be examining a question that a lot of people have regarding the consequences of probing into other people's flaws. You know, all human beings, they're flawed. They have, you know, problems. They make mistakes. You know, they have, some of them have some bad qualities in them. Nobody can claim, besides the infallibles, nobody can claim that he is perfect, right? So at the same time, we have been prohibited in Islam and in our religion from probing into other people's flaws. In the Holy Quran, God Almighty says, avoid much suspicion. Indeed, some suspicions are sins. And do not spy or backbite one another. Will any of you love to eat the flesh of his dead brother? You would hate it. And be wary of Allah. Indeed, Allah is all clement, all merciful. Right, so this is definitely a sin. We call this in Arabic, tajassus. Now, the question is, what happens if we do such a thing? What will be the consequences of it? What will be the effects of this unbecoming act and this sin? Fortunately, the answer to this question has been alluded to in many hadiths. For example, the Holy Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam has been narrated to have said, "Do not probe for flaws in believers. For a man that probes into the flaws of his brother will have Allah probe in his own faults." Meaning, if we probe into the faults of others and seek out their faults and look into them and investigate it, Allah Ta'ala will investigate into the flaws of this person. And you know the effects and the consequences of that. Of course, this doesn't mean that, you know, that Allah Ta'ala, he doesn't have knowledge of what this person is doing, right? And he's waiting for this person to spy into, you know, the affairs of his brother, and then Allah goes and looks into his affairs and realizes what this person is doing. No, Allah has this knowledge, right? Probably what this hadith means is that Allah will act upon that knowledge, right? And, you know, punish this person or afflict him with some calamity as a punishment for this sin. And perhaps this is the reason why, in continuation of the hadith, the Holy Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam says, "And when Allah probes the flaws of a man, He will expose him, even if he were inside his own home." So the probe, Allah's probing into this person, into the flaws of this person, doesn't mean that Allah will investigate and come to realize what this person is doing. It means that He will expose him to the people. He will allow people to, you know, come to realize what this person is doing, right? And then he will be, you know, he will be shamed in front of the people. He will lose his honor in front of the people. So this is one of the consequences of probing into the flaws of other people mentioned in the hadith of the Prophet. Another worldly effect, which has been alluded to again in the hadith, is this, that if a person begins to investigate into the flaws of other people, he will become friendless. People will stop befriending him. Nobody will want to be this person's friend, you know, and, you know, he will lose all his friends. Imam Sadiq alayhi salam said, "Do not probe into the religiosity of people, lest you remain without a friend." Bila sadiqin. Thank you for joining us here on The Key. We were looking at the consequences of probing into other people's flaws. Until next time, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Shiraz Hussein Agha, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom and a PhD in philosophy, on the program The Key on IRIB English Radio.
You can also send your questions to English Radio at irib.ir.
This is IRIB English Radio. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
The fabricated regime of Israel is so atrocious that it must be removed from the face of planet Earth, so that not only Palestinians, but also all the oppressed people around the world will have the chance to live in peace. On the Zionist regime's recent crimes against Palestinians, we have looked at some of the world media websites for further details. Stay tuned, please. the website of Crescent International wrote, "The illegitimate Zionist regime has escalated its war on defenseless Palestinians in the West Bank and East Al-Quds. Within a span of 3 days, five Palestinians, all of them minors, were shot and killed by the Zionists. Another Palestinian, Osama Adawi, 18, was shot dead recently by Israeli regime troops in Al-Arab camp in Al-Khalil." The Palestinian Health Ministry said, bringing the number of Palestinian youth killed to 6. Meanwhile, the Nablus-based Lion's Den resistance group called for days of rage against Israeli occupation in a statement and urged citizens to join in the strikes and protests near Israeli regime checkpoints. The localities targeted are the sprawling Palestinian refugee camp at Jenin, the northern city of Nablus, and Ramallah. On October 8 morning, heavily armed Israeli regime troops using armored vehicles, bulldozers, military helicopters, and combat drones attacked Jenin. The invading forces shot dead 2 Palestinian teenagers there. The Palestinian Health Ministry named the youths shot and killed as Mahmoud Assos, 18, and Ahmad Daragma, 16. Assos was shot in the neck and Daragma was hit in the head. At least 11 more Palestinians were wounded, 3 of whom remain in critical condition. These murders and injuries occurred after 2 more minors, including a 14-year-old boy, were killed near Galilea and Ramallah the night before. Adel Ibrahim Dawood, 14, was shot in the head near the Zionist regime's separation barrier in Galilea. Mahdi Ladawe, 17, another victim of Israeli regime criminality, was shot in the chest near Ramallah. Meanwhile, a Palestinian child, 12-year-old Mahmoud Muhammad Samoudi, was hit in the stomach by an Israeli bullet during the September 28 army attack on Jenin and died on October 10th. The Zionist regime's killing of Palestinians has gone on amid the siege of Shafat refugee camp in Zionist-occupied East Al-Quds. Residents of the refugee camp, that number more than 120,000, have been besieged in their locality for 4 days. Palestinians needing critical medical treatment, dialysis or cancer treatment, are unable to go to hospital. Basic supplies, such as food and water, are also running low due to the tight Israeli regime blockade. Why has the Zionist regime blockaded Shafat? The occupation army alleges that a man who approached the checkpoint leading to the camp opened fire. The Zionist regime police identified the suspect as a 22-year-old resident of Shafat. He is still at large, but his mother, father, and brother have all been detained, according to Zionist media reports. Places like Jenin, Nablus, and Ramallah are special targets for the Zionist regime occupation forces. Both Jenin and Nablus have become hubs of resistance activity, although the price for Palestinians is quite steep. More than 160 Palestinians have been killed by Israeli regime fire this year, including 50 in the Gaza Strip. The remainder, 110 Palestinians, have been killed in the occupied West Bank and East Al-Quds. The death toll rate in the West Bank is the highest recorded in a single year since 2014. Heavily armed Zionist squatters, as known as Israeli settlers, now routinely storm Masjid al-Aqsa as well as destroy Palestinian olive trees and harvest. The Zionist occupiers also continue to force Palestinians off their land in Masafer Yatta. Of the 750 Palestinian political prisoners held under Israeli regime's illegal administrative detention policy, some than 30 are on hunger strike to protest their mistreatment. They are demanding their release. Only the Zionist occupiers are able to get away with such crimes. It is an outlaw regime that must be removed from Palestine if its people are to have a chance to live in peace. Al Jazeera English wrote in its website, Israeli regime forces have shot dead a Palestinian in a refugee camp in the occupied West Bank. The Palestinian Health Ministry has said, Osama Adabi, 18, was killed by occupation Israeli military live fire to the stomach in Al Arab camp. In southern West Bank, the Health Ministry said, official Palestinian news agency Wafa said he was killed in confrontations during which Israeli regime forces shot at Palestinians and used tear gas. Another person was injured in the Al Arab camp and was in moderate condition in hospital, Wafa reported. The Israeli regime military said the troops pursued people who were throwing rock stones vehicles on a road near the camp.
Seven, very much pressure.
We come to you, and O God, knowing that thou art our only King.
You're listening to the program Bookshelf on IRIB English Radio with Brother Yasser Ibrahim.
A'udhu billahi min ash-shaytani rajim. Bismillahi r-Rahmani r-Rahim. Alhamdulillahi rabbil alamin. Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa ali Muhammad wa ajjil farajuhum. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, dear listeners. Welcome to another episode of Bookshelf on IRIB English Radio with me, Brother Yasser Ibrahim. Islam, especially a true understanding of Islam, requires a person to be well-versed in many different subjects. In the Islamic world, or in the Islamic tradition, a person who is well-versed in a majority of the Islamic sciences is called Allama. It is one of the particular traditional epithets, or what you want to call it, nicknames that a person will be given is Allama. For example, Allama Hassan Zadi Amali, Rahmatullah Alayh, Allama Tabatabai, and so on and so forth. In that aspect, you can actually say the author of the particular book that we will be presenting today can also be called an Allama. And there's absolutely nothing wrong with it. But a higher title is the one that he's actually given. And we will mention that in our next segment. But the book that also we would like to introduce today deals with a particular grouping of sciences within the Islamic studies or within Islam. And again, this is not limited, or rather the Islamic sciences is not limited to these particular subjects or disciplines that are mentioned here by this particular author. There are other sciences within the Islamic tradition that also are taught, that are also necessary. But the author did not mention it in this particular, or not brought in this particular book, for whatever reason. So inshallah, in staying with us in order to introduce this book to our dear listeners, inshallah, until our next segment.
Why do we read books in the first place? What are books good for?
We read books because we don't want to reinvent the wheel, if you will.
We'd better take advantage of human cultural and intellectual heritage, particularly related to our daily activities, such as our physical, mental, spiritual, or even religious health.
We can't ignore the past thoughts and experiences. To do so, we need to boost our bookshelf.
Welcome back, dear listeners, to our program Bookshelf on IRIB English Radio. So the book that we would like to introduce to our dear listeners is titled Understanding Islamic Sciences. The book was, again, it was written by Shaheed Murtada Mutahari, Rahmatullah Alayh. Again, as we mentioned, he is Allama, but as we mentioned, he is Shaheed Murtada Mutahari. So that title of Shaheed obviously has a higher connotation in terms of the Islamic tradition, in terms of his status and so on and so forth. Anyway. So this book basically is a collection of a set of speeches that Shaheed Mutahari gave in Tehran on the various different Islamic sciences. So these speeches and these particular discussions were gathered, were written down from the tapes, published obviously first in Farsi, and then published into English. This particular translation that I will be introducing is the first edition of that particular book. Now, first of all, we need to understand that the book itself was not formed in a book. Firstly, these particular lectures that were delivered by the Shaheed that were first translated into English in the Tawheed Journal by various different translators. So the one that we have is the compilation of those particular translations in At-Tawheed Journal by the various translators. So one of those translators is Ali Kuli Quray, another one of those translators is Salman Tawhidi, and another of those translators are Campbell. So these particular five articles from that journal were compiled into one book titled Understanding Islamic Sciences by the Islamic College of Advanced Studies in London, so ICAS Press. So they combined these particular articles from At-Tawheed and published it as a book. This book has been published in two editions. So the one I am presenting today is the first edition. If Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala suppose, we'll produce the or present the second edition at a later date. So this first one was published in the year 2002. And the next one was published a lot later on with certain glosses and explanations and an edited version. This one that I will be introducing has five parts. It discusses Islamic philosophy, Islamic theology, Islamic mysticism, Islamic morality, Islamic jurisprudence, it comes with six parts, and the principles of jurisprudence. There is one thing that is missing, which is logic, which the new edition has added. So logic or mantiq is not in this one, it is in the new edition. So inshallah, if we get a chance, we will introduce maybe that new edition in our next segment. So again, in this one, this particular edition, instead of seven disciplines, six disciplines are discussed. And hopefully, inshallah, in our next segment, we'll be reading a portion of this book for the benefit of our dear listeners. So please stay tuned.
Among the sacred texts we have received to help us understand where we came from and where we are going as a human race are most rich in helping us find our direction. They narrate stories of our past. But where have they brought us? Where are their messages now? Are we the people of belief, or have we become the people of the boxes? Is there wisdom trapped in our bookshelves? Bookshelves, bookshelves, bookshelves.
Welcome back, dear listeners, to our program Bookshelf on IRIB English Radio with me, Brother Yasser Ibrahim. So the book that we introduced to our dear listeners is titled Islamic Understanding Islamic Sciences by the Shaheed Murtada Mutahari, Rahmatullah Alayh. It deals with seven disciplines, but this particular edition that we have introduced today only deals with six. The discipline of logic or mantiq was not brought into this particular edition, and as we mentioned, it was brought into the next one. So we will be reading from part 3, Irfan, Islamic Mysticism. Irfan is one of the disciplines that originated within the realm of Islamic culture and developed there to attain a high level of sophistication. But before we can begin to discuss Irfan, we must realize that it can be approached from two viewpoints, the social and the academic. Unlike the scholars of other Islamic disciplines, such as the Quranic commentators, the Mufassirun, the scholars of Hadith, the Muhaddithun, the jurisprudents, Fuqaha, the theologians, Mutakallimeen, the philosophers, Hukama, the men of literature and the poets, the Adibs, or the Udaba, the Urafa, are a group of scholars who have not only developed their own science, Irfan, producing great scholars and important books, but have also given rise within the Islamic world to a distinct social grouping. In this, the Urafa are unique. For the scholars of the other Islamic disciplines, the jurists, for instance, form solely academic groupings and are not viewed as a social group distinct from the rest of society. In view of this distinction, the Gnostics, when referred to as belonging to a certain academic discipline, are called Urafa, and when referred to as a social group are generally called Sufis or Mutasawwifa. The Urafa and the Sufis are not regarded as forming a separate sect in Islam, nor do they claim to be such. They are to be found within every Islamic school and sect, yet at the same time, they coalesce to form a distinct social group. The factors that set them apart from the rest of Islamic society are a distinctive set of ideas and opinions, a special code governing their social intercourse, dress, and even sometimes the way they wear their hair and beards, and the fact that they live communally in hospices, which is the Persian for Khanqa, Aribat, Zawaya, Tikke, and so on and so forth. We ask Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala to enable us to get a true understanding of the Islamic sciences, to bless the elevated soul of Shaykh Mutahhari, rahmatullah alayh, and to give us ability to understand the words of our great scholars, inshaAllah. Until next time, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah wa barakatuh.
That was the program Bookshelf with Brother Yasser Ibrahim on RIB English Radio.
Comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.